Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 5th, 2016, and welcome to episode 10 million of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and alternate numeric systems. Hi guys, how are you?
Quiet.
Great.
Good.
Awesome. Well,
awesome. That didn't sound like Carrington. Hey, Carrington, you're back.
What about it?
Mr. C. It's great to hear your voice, man.
Yeah,
I am slumming again.
Yeah, we were referring to you as the voiceover guy. Welcome back. So how's the weather up in sunny Toronto?
It is sunny Toronto,
that's good. Wouldn't mind a little bit of sun here to help dry things out. It's been just a little bit on the damp side here on the east coast of Australia. Well, maybe not the whole east coast, about two-thirds of it, from southern Queensland all the way down to Victoria. It's just been raining its little head off. Roads flooded, people being evacuated. It's lots of fun, but we're okay out here on the property. Meanwhile, over on the other East Coast, hi, Paul.
Hello. How are you? Well, I guess you just told us.
Yes.
I am fine, though. It's kind of rainy here, but I don't think it's as rainy as there.
No. Okay, and then a quick flick back to the West Coast. Hi, Earl. What's up?
Hey there, Michael. I'd be happy to give you some of our sunshine. It is unseasonably hot here. We're going to break 100 degrees Fahrenheit today, which I think in Celsius is somewhere around 300. So it's going to be a scorcher.
Pretty close. What's Portland doing with that kind of temperature? I thought you were the rainy capital of the U.S.
Normally, it's drizzly and a little overcast and a lot cooler in June, but it's just really warm. So we're staying inside in the AC.
We must have sucked all the rain out of the rest of the planet and deposited it on top of ourselves. We'll have to stop doing that. And meanwhile, in some other part of the world, also known as Sweden. Hi, Jack. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. I've been kind of hunched over all day because I've been outside oiling my decks, which is pretty brutal.
There's a euphemism.
So to speak.
So it was squeaky, or you just need to reduce the friction?
Oil can.
One of those. No, you know, it's I get out a brush and a can of oil, like with deck oil, and I'm just swiping, you know.
In my wizard robe.
I put on my hat and a wizard robe. No, but it's hard work. It takes a long time. It's not hard. It's not difficult. It's just it's like bad on my back. I feel like I'm just going to fall over here. But
it's pretty grueling.
Yeah.
I have to do that in a few weeks here.
We have four separate deck surfaces next to and around our house, and I got two of them done.
Well, you live in Versailles? What the hell, dude? Who has four decks? And is complaining about his life.
Oh, this guy.
Life is so hard with my four decks and two thumbs. Yeah.
Alas, alack. Oh, well, it's good to have you all here. It's also a semi-momentous occasion, being episode 128, so I'm glad we could get the numbers up for today's show. Okay, well, host topic. I was wondering about that one, and I was going through my news feed and found an interesting item. So there was a volunteer at the National Museum of Computing over in the UK who made an amazing eBay find. They actually found a Lorenz Cypher Machine keyboard. It was advertised on eBay as a telegram terminal, but not quite. So someone who recognized it for what it was managed to pick it up for the princely sum of £9.50. So that got me thinking, what has been your most unexpected find on eBay, or at a garage sale, or even a flea market, or whatever your global equivalent is? So let's start with Carrington. What has been your most unexpected find?
Yep, we call them yard sales here, or occasionally garage sales. And years ago, many, many, many years ago, I think this would have been late 80s, early 90s, I bought a bunch of discs, floppy discs, from a garage sale, from a yard sale, and on them found, as one does, a bunch of data, old data, from previous owners. And some of the items on there were homework from a fellow named Stavros, and I recognized both the assignments and the name of my good friend Stavros from years earlier. But still in Toronto, so this is all in the same city, but this family selling these discs had nothing to do with Stavros, and I had been long out of touch with him for years. So I got a hold of Stavros and told him the amazing news that I've just come across some of his old homework on old floppy disks. So we got together, had lunch, caught up, which was amazing, gave him the floppy disks, and then later heard back from him that, no, it was a totally different Stavros. So, unfortunately, it's not as interesting a story as it could have been or first appeared to be, but that's kind of the most I had to bring to the table. So I found homework, which I once thought was that of a friend of mine, and that's what I've got.
So did you copy it first?
No, I just gave him the disks.
Oh, I thought you were always into copying homework. Okay.
If they had been freshly still sealed, I would have opened them. I like to do that. Mm. But no. So really don't have any other, you know, exciting finds from eBay. I've purchased things and they have sometimes been disappointingly not what they were purported to be, but never excitingly new other things. But for the most part, the things I've purchased have been what I anticipated and haven't got a lot from yard sales. But I got the one almost story out of it. Yeah. So that's what I have to contribute.
Oh, I think the almost story was almost as good as the story that wasn't almost. So, Earl, what have you come across?
Well, I've never really had a fantastic, oh my gosh, find. I did at Goodwill one time find a TRS-80 Model 1 in fairly decent shape for $5. And I purchased it, and all it needed was a new fuse, and the thing came right up and worked. And so for $5, that wasn't so bad. I wound up selling it on eBay for $35. And in fact, Randy Kindig purchased it from me. And that was, I think, even back before he started podcasting. So that was pretty fun. He still has that to this day. But the real exciting eBay thing was not something that I bought, but something that I sold. I was cruising around on eBay for accessories for my HP 41C. And as I was doing this, I noticed, oh my gosh, people are selling HP 41Cs for more than $200. And that was a total shock to me. I didn't realize that those were so collectible and so desired out there. And it wasn't really a huge, you know, what would I say, cornerstone of my collection. So I was like, $200, man. So I sold it. And mine sold for more than $200. And I think that's probably the best deal I ever had, because I bought it for $50 when it was brand new on a blowout sale, had used it for all those years and had a lot of fun with it, and then sold it for four times more than I bought it for. So I think that went pretty well. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Good calculators, though.
Yeah, I don't think I quite have anything that I could quite get that kind of return on, but no. So, Jack, have you had any unexpected finds?
I am kind of drawing a blank here. I think the things I bought on eBay that I found, nothing has ever been surprising. And I have to say that of all the things that I love in Sweden, the garage sale flea market scene is not one of them. I go to these things, I always hope. I'm always hoping, oh, maybe I'll find something interesting. But the nearest I find any kind of vintage computer stuff typically is like a dirty old Packard Bell keyboard or something. Just like it's never – I just don't find anything –
I've been called
that. Anything good. I never find anything good here. It's terrible. So, sorry. Pass.
Well, Paul, we all know about your great searchability on eBay, but have you ever come across something unexpected?
Well, no World War II, cipher machines, no. But, I definitely have... Yeah, I was surprised. I'm kind of surprised at how little I'm coming up with on this score as well. I think probably the most amazing thing that showed up unexpectedly was the manual for personal software Zork, which is it was before it was Infocom. It was sold by Personal Software, and they had this really sort of like very artistic, elaborate, not very related to the game painting on the front of this thing. So if you've seen it, it's like, I'm not even sure what it is. It's like some guy holding a sword up to some kind of like troll or something. But it's very sort of D&D-esque. But I had no idea that was in there. I mean, it was just sort of sitting in inside the cover of some book, and that's quite something. Had I sold that on eBay, it would have been a lot, I think. I actually managed to hand it off for just a sort of like nominal respect the real, what it is kind of price to someone who was looking for it for a long time, and so I was kind of happy to be able to do that. But that was it was pretty crazy to see that there unexpectedly.
There's the full boxed version of that version of Zork, which came both bagged and boxed. I think the boxed version is currently on eBay.
Yeah.
For I think $1,500 or something.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's the picture.
Mm. Oh, I've had a few little, almost interesting items. It's more along the lines of you purchase or you get exactly what you've ordered, but it's finding something else hidden inside. So, picked up an Apple II carry bag, and inside that there was some business magazines. So I had they were the Lotus 123 magazine. That was actually a little bit on the interesting side. But the most interesting one was I picked up some Apple QuickTake 150 cameras, and they'd been advertised, no cable. I haven't tested them, but I was just after some ones that I could just have available for parts, if I needed. But finally got it, plugged it in, and there were some photos on the internal memory. Now, the documentation for the QuickTake say that without battery power, that the images will only be there for a couple of years. But these had been languishing in a dusty corner of the RAM for looked like about pretty much when the cameras first came out in the early 90s. But on there was some pictures of what looked to be a church camp, one of those retreat style things. And every now and again I try to do a Google picture search on that one just to see if I can find out who it is and see if they're interested in it. So, but the building doesn't turn up, the pictures, the people's faces don't turn up. So
that screams to be a Tumblr site.
Well, I wonder if this is an alternate dimension you're looking at in here.
I hadn't thought of the parallel universe perspective.
Right. Alternate world where the building was there.
Apple did advertise that the QuickTake 150 could steal your soul. That was one of the reasons it didn't sell very well, I think.
But no. So that's about as unexpected as I've found. Unfortunately, when I see something on eBay and I buy it, it really, that's what it turned out to be. So I really wish that I could find something like the Lorenz keyboard. That was definitely an interesting find, and I'm just glad that it was someone at the museum there that spotted it, and that's been added to the collection of, now they're just looking for a few other bits to go with it, just to round it out.
America's also put them on a no-fly list.
What, the UK?
No, for yes, all of the UK. If Trump gets in, all of the UK will be on a no-fly list.
Okay. Well, if any of our listeners have found anything unexpected, or not quite what it was advertised as, but came out interesting, drop us a line. We'd love to hear about your unexpected finds.
Also, if you find a motor to the Lorenz machine, let the museum know.
If you find a motor for a Lorenz machine, the National Museum of Computing would love to be in contact with you. Okay. Well, I think it's time for some news. So, Carrington, you're a little old programmer. What's writing a game in assembly taught you?
It has taught me, personally, nothing. But it has taught others some other things. A fellow named Matt Lacey wrote something up on Medium about writing a game in assembler for the Atari Falcon, a computer I don't think I was even familiar with. According to the article, it came out in 92 and then went away in 93. So he decided to pick up one of these things and therefore write something for it, as one does when you pick up an old computer, and found that it taught him some interesting lessons for modern programming. And, you know, I think there were three lessons. it didn't teach him a lot of stuff, and I think it was like have a goal, don't optimize early, and persevere, or something like that. But it's an interesting read. Okay, so this one fellow wrote a game and learned three things from it. But this is what I have to contribute. Have you missed me on the show, folks? it is actually a good read, and I would recommend it, mostly because I never heard of the Atari Falcon. Cool looking little computer from the graphics, and well written little article. And mostly it's just neat when vintage assembly programming makes the news in any sort. So this is what I'm throwing on the round table to start with.
That was an 030 based computer, wasn't it?
Yep.
68030?
Yep, that's right.
Okay.
Well, sure. it seems like that would totally be was a little complicated. I mean, if you were going to write assembly for an old computer, a 68030 with, you know, writing on a machine that you got to hook into all the graphics and GUI and stuff like that, it must have been quite an adventure just to pick that up.
Maybe it was like the Mac, though, that was a lot of toolbox calls you could write to. I don't know. Hmm. I would assume there's some sort of toolbox.
Yeah, there must have been something. I mean, I think this was, the Falcon was kind of an evolution of the Atari ST series. So I think like the basic, if you knew how to code for the Atari ST, you could probably code up something for this reasonably well. But yeah, I don't know. He didn't really go into details about what tools he used or too much about where he got his info. Yeah, it was a good read. I saw this on Facebook and then I posted it on Twitter. It's one of the most retweeted things I've ever posted on Twitter. People seem to love this article. So yeah, thank you very much.
Nice.
couldn't be more proud.
Good.
That's going to be my second item of news later on. I'm going to talk about the retweeting of you. You set the internet on fire there, Jack.
Awesome.
Way to go. I'm actually trying to find the tweet so I can retweet it right now.
That retweet just needs to be retweeted.
It does.
So while Carrington's trying to figure out how to use Twitter, Earl, you've got a couple of...
I'd just like to point out, I've already retweeted.
Hooray.
Earl, ZAD excitement. I can't think of anything more exciting.
Thank you for reminding me to say Z and not Z. Or maybe there's
What was that? What was that buzzing sound in front of the 80?
There's got to be some in-between sound that'll make everybody happy. But that old Zilog processor... lots of excitement. It's
pronounced Z-log.
About it. Or Z-I-log?
Zeddy-log.
Zeddy-log. I want to thank Scott and Tony for shooting us some feedback, and I just want to personally say CPM Forever, great operating system, killed all, just, man, he killed it. He killed it all. So what am I talking about, though? I don't even remember what I'm talking about. Downshifting to a less complex processor than the O30, there are several things that are going on right now that are exciting in the Z80 world. One is a blog where someone chronicled the construction of an 8-bit Z80 computer built from scratch. And it's a really interesting blog. Lots of postings, lots of technical info about the problems that he went through and all such. And we'll have a link to that up in the show notes. And it's just kind of fun to see all the proto boards. Another is, do you guys remember MicroB? I thought, wasn't it an Australian company?
That's an Australian one, yep.
Yeah, and from the early 80s, the brand is still around, and they're working right now on a prototype of a Z80-based computer with a full-stroke keyboard and all the fixings. And I looked on their site, and honestly, the prototype looks beautiful. Would not mind having one of these for myself.
Well, you say that now, but Australian computers ship full of spiders. Come on.
And those scary lizard things.
Hey, my lace monitors aren't scary. Well, maybe the 5-6 foot long one is, but yeah.
Yeah, just wow. But this computer doesn't look scary. This computer looks cool.
Mm.
And to round out the ZD excitement, there is another computer that's generating some buzz, the RC2014 Z80 computer. This was one that was made for one of the Retro Challenge events and then just kind of took on a life of its own. You can actually go over to Tindy and buy one if you want, and there are several different ways you can buy it. You can just buy the bare printed circuit boards and source all the components yourself, all the way up to what they call the Full Monty, which I think was $88 US, where you can buy the whole kit and caboodle, including all the chips that you need to make this. And for good measure, there is some conversations going on over on Google Groups for what you can do with this baby once you solder it all together. So, you know, long live the Z80 or Z80, however you want to pronounce it. I don't care what you call it. Just make sure that you get one or two. Or three, actually. We gave you three different choices here. The one you can't buy yet, the MicroB technology, but you do want to stay tuned. They are actively tweeting their progress. They run around and do things like go to maker fairs and such, and they have some other kits and other components if you want to take a look. We'll have a link for that stuff in the show notes. Back to you, Michael.
Thank you, Earl. No, there's some good kit in those links. So, Jack, you found this little site for us retro people.
Yeah, well...
It sounds familiar.
It does sound familiar. We've talked about this before, I'm pretty sure. This is the Retro Computing Stack Exchange site, which we mentioned, I believe, some time ago when it was still in kind of a proposal state. And now it is a real thing and exists, and I answered one question. And interestingly enough, I think that one of the guys behind this, the proposal initially, was Matt Lacey, the same guy who wrote that article about coding and Falcon game. So it all comes around. Anyway, I think it seems pretty interesting. There's not a whole lot of questions on there yet, but there's an interesting sort of range of questions. And I guess as someone who occasionally looks at Atari forums and that sort of thing, it's interesting to see a spot where people are asking questions and things about not only Atari, but Commodore and Apple and everything else. So seems interesting, and someone said that people are already complaining about this, which just means it's probably perfectly valid site. So,
Atari forums, are they available at like boo.com or
yes?
Where would one find those?
Boo.com, booatari.com.
So that's a little bit harsh.
Oh, you haven't heard him off, Mike.
Oh, I've offed Mike. Just ask Mike.
Yes.
Anyway, if you're interested in finding answers to your questions in an interesting new way and you like the Stack Exchange format, there you go. retrocomputing.stackexchange.com.
No, it's good to see it up and running now. So we'd been through the various stages of the proposal and the beta, and it's good to see that it's now fully enabled and just waiting to help you. So not only is it a good place to go if you want to ask a question, I think that people who have been in the retro computing field for a while should really drop by and see if they can offer some advice and answer some of those questions as they pop up. So it definitely needs to have some support from those in the know to help those getting into retro computing, or if they just hit something that they just need a little bit of help. So pop over, have a look, see what you can do. Okay, well, here's a little article about some historical hacking. So over at the National Museum of Computing, Robert Scheifen, a white hat hacker from the 80s, has donated all his papers and whatnot from a two-year legal ordeal from when he quite openly hacked into Prestel, which is a BT pre-internet online system. And what was most interesting about it is that he hacked into Prince Philip's email. Now, that's for those not part of the empire, that is the Queen's husband. He is a quiet, demure gentleman who is always putting his foot in his mouth. He has an opinion about everything, and his emails probably would have been a good read. But back then, it technically wasn't illegal what Schiffen was doing. And there was a two-year court battle. So the end result is that he got off. But it did show and highlight the need for laws specifically against computer hacking. So I think that came into effect in the early 90s. So never let it be said that our lawmakers are slow. So you know, it took them almost a decade to actually put something in place, but they finally did. So it says that the information's available to bona fide researchers. So some of it, I'm hoping, will be released sooner rather than later. But I just like the way that they went about it. So, you know, even just down to things where they started hacking the system after 6 p.m. when the dial-up rates were cheaper because the phone dialing costs were quite expensive back then. But also, 6 p.m. was when the Prestel security team hung up their, well, they grabbed their hats and coats and went home, basically. So all of the alerts and things that were going off, and it seems they had some voice alerts and things. So they exited out, and the hackers came in. So it was a good sort of rotating door. So
it's also very British.
Yes.
Because it's like the security people are like, well, hacking after business hours would not be cricket.
No, it's just not the done thing. Like, no. If we're here protecting things during business hours, the hackers should be coming during business hours. But no, I just thought that was quite amusing that that they weren't intentionally going in after the security team had left. It was just serendipity that the cheap dialing rates came in just as the security guys were going home. So something just there for a little bit of a read. As I said, I'm really looking forward to having some of those papers released over the coming time. So I've got myself a little bit of a Google search saved on that one, so if anything pops up. Okay, Paul, Apple II.
Oh, yeah, I guess I have two bullet points here in this part of the show notes. Yeah. I was thinking about what happened today, and it seems that June 5th is the beginning of the first ship date of the Apple II week. Nobody seems to have any idea when this actually happened. It might have been the 5th, it might have been the 10th, it might have been the 11th. But anyway, so... but what I actually wanted to say... I'll have a link to a blog post by Ken who kind of like lays out some of the different options that he has found back in 2011 or something. But the thing I was going to actually talk about was something we got over feedback some time ago as a link to the CPU Shack Museum, which I thought this was kind of interesting. It's not actually a particularly recent posting there. This, I guess, was posted on February 21st, 2013, or at least the first part of it was. It's a two-part sort of article looking at Chuck Moore's processor designs. Chuck Moore is someone who he invented the fourth programming language and then went on to actually sort of make design processors that were optimized for running fourth. And so it sort of lays out some of the things that he did. And apparently some of the processors that these Novix, I think they are, processors that he designed are flying around Mercury currently. So yeah, there's two parts, right? The second part is in March 2013, and it's sort of interesting just to sort of to hear the history of this and read at least about a different architecture for these processor types. I actually don't know enough about how processors work to know what it means for it to be a fourth processor and not to have registers and working directly on the stack and all these things that are kind of beyond my ability to understand. But I think it's cool that the guy who wrote the fourth language made a sort of hardware optimized for it. And it is possible. This design is actually still going now, and you can buy like sort of modern fourth chips from Green Arrays. I think this is his company, Green Arrays Incorporated, where they have, you can buy the chips, the GA144 1.20 chip, with 144 self-contained computers and software-defined I/O on a chip. You can buy these to experiment with, and they also sell an evaluation board with all the sort of connections to it, so you can do a kind of like a computer project. So I thought it would be kind of neat, in all my free time, to maybe get one or two of these and see, see what you can do, see how you operate with a fourth chip that has a different architecture from what I'm used to, or at least I'd like to try to figure out what that is. So anyway, I thought it was neat. It was a neat link, and it's kind of interesting history I didn't really know anything about fourth, except just basically kind of how it works as a language. So anyway, thanks Tony for sending that.
Yeah. And one of the other choices that you have, Paul, if you want to play around with this, if you ever do wind up getting into FPGA experimentation, there are, I think, several different soft CPUs, that is, FPGA configurations that implement a CPU targeted or optimized for fourth. One of them that's kind of popular is called the J1 fourth CPU. Mm-hmm. And one of the noteworthy things about it, it's really optimized and small. One of the languages that people use to program FPGAs is called Verilog. And this CPU is implemented in 200 lines of that language. So, one of the nice things about that is you can actually go through that code, and if you understand Verilog, it's easy to understand how this chip works. It's really straightforward, and it's like what you were saying, it's not a register-based CPU, it's a stack-based CPU. So pretty much everything that the fourth language does is done in the stack, and so having a CPU that uses a stack rather than being real register-heavy kind of makes sense.
Yeah, isn't it about like it doesn't have... Doesn't you use like a second stack instead of just local variables? Like it's something like that, isn't it? It's been forever since I've touched fourth.
Yeah, there's a return stack.
Return stack, right? Yeah, you have the two stacks, right? So it's mm-hmm. a very silly way to do a language, to be honest. Sorry, dude, with your stuff around Mercury, but there's a reason why this was a non-starter and we don't do this now. It seems crazy to me.
Yeah,
that's what I say.
It's intriguing.
It does seem crazy. Once you get into it, it's actually pretty interesting. There's a lot of power there. Like basically, it sort of says, okay, all of these things that you make syntax for in normal languages, like calling functions and returning values and stuff. We don't need that. We can use the stack for everything. And it's bizarre, but it's pretty fun. I was gonna say, if anyone wants to try out fourth or a fourth-like language on your modern computer in a pretty simple, easy-to-use way. There's a language called Factor at factorcode.org. They have, at least for Mac and for Windows, they have a nifty little GUI app where you can type things, and you can examine the stack and all this stuff. Of course, there are command line versions of Forth also, but the Factor gives you an interesting sort of view on things, I've found. I've not built anything real with it, but it's kind of fun to play with.
Ooh, I've never seen that. I'm going to go play with it right now. I'll see you guys.
Okay.
Catch you later. Well, Carrington, while Earl's gone forth, you've got a little bit of digital computer history.
I do indeed. I found this. There's another thing for Medium, but I had actually found this before the last time I was supposed to be on the show, so it's a slightly older link, but really, really neat. So there's a fellow named Nick Dorian, I think it was, has compiled a list by country of each country's first computer. Most people, when you talk about first computers, everybody throws out, well, ENIAC. So, but it's interesting to see, well, what was like the first computer commercially available from Mexico, from Belarus, from Switzerland? Because every country, for the most part, has had computer development, so they've made their own computers. Many of these I had never heard of, including, crazily, Canada's first computer, which was called the Ferret. And it's a great trivia question, because a lot of people, when you say, what was the first commercially available computer, everyone says ENIAC. Great bar question. What was the world's second commercially available computer? Turns out it was the Ferret, made in Canada, right here in Toronto. And I never even heard of this thing. So I'll link both to the article so you can look up your own favorite country's first computers. And we'll link to a Ferret site as well so you can read about Canada's first contribution and just missed being the first commercially available computer overall, but takes second place to the ENIAC.
Cool. I see the T in Ferret is for Toronto.
The T in all words is for Toronto.
That's true, of course.
Little known fact, all words are acronyms, and they all stand for Toronto.
Okay. Maybe in some other alternate reality?
Well, yeah.
Lucky you have a T in your name, Carrington.
Oh, there's actually T's in all words, just some of them are not just silent, but invisible. I'm doubling down on my ass. You know what?
Get us back on the rails, Michael.
Yeah. Okay.
Had you guys heard of the Ferret, though, guys? But am I the only one here? Did everybody else know about the Ferret? Because this was totally news to me.
No.
Nope.
That's great.
See, exactly.
The Franti Mark One sounds sort of familiar.
Yeah, I covered a little bit about the Franti a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah, but who listens to this show, right? So. Nobody listens.
But, yeah, there's Cyrac there from Australia in 49, which was earlier than for a digital stored computer, early than the Canadian one.
That's not true, because dates actually begin in 1953, and it scrolls over. So, so you were actually like almost 100 years
later. I'd love to visit your alternate reality sometime, Cameron, Carrington. I'm sure it would be interesting.
In the other reality, I am called Cameron.
I've just been thinking of another friend of mine who's got a slightly warped perspective on the world. Okay.
His name is Ferris.
Meanwhile.
Yeah. I was wondering if that was where that was going to go.
Of course it's going to go there. Everything always eventually leads to Ferris Bueller.
Okay.
Also spelled with a T.
Meanwhile, in Legoland, over at Chris McVeigh's website, he's got two new models. And I'm torn between which one to get, or should I just get both? So what he's doing is, it's his desktop series. So you can order the DOS desktop or the Byte desktop. He likes using the word byte. I think he's trying to avoid some fruity sort of problems. But it's a nice little Lego desk with a chair. You got your computer on it and some other paraphernalia there. And both look quite good little models. A little bit on the pricey side, but I think that for the true Lego retro geek in us, wouldn't mind shelling out $99.50 US. Well, Some of us would. At least it's small. I could hide it from the wife so she wouldn't find it, or I could just say it's part of my Lego collection. But no, it looks real good. So I went for a bit of a stroll just to refamiliarize myself with what's available. And there's another in his first computer edition. So it's the DOS edition. So he has a nice model of a DOS PC-style computer and monitor. So unfortunately, that's currently out of stock. But with all his models, there are building guides available. So if you're wanting to put it together yourself, you can use his building guide. And to go with a nice computer like that, unfortunately also out of stock, but somewhat cheaper, is a rotary phone. So a rotary dial phone. Looks quite nice. I think all it's calling out for is a little Lego acoustic modem kit to go with it.
That is pretty cool.
But again, it's a building guide is available at his website. So just we'll include the link to the desktop series, and there will also be links to the PC and the phone. And from there, you can follow and find his building guides. So guys, would you find a spot for any of these in your Lego collection?
These are super cool. Yeah, I like these a lot.
Everything there's super cool.
If you go to the technology page and then the second page, you can also get just the screens. The last three things there are you can get a brick tool screen, which has little. Actually, they're Apple II characters. This looks like the file transfer file copying program, just printed on a brick.
Ah, yeah, just to click into the screen section. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, and you have hello like as on the Mac, and static for all your other computers. It's very cool.
Oh well, that's sometimes what just displays when we hook a computer in for the first time when we've bought it untested, no returns.
Right, or it's a ZX81.
That too.
I would like to point out as a public service announcement that the plural of Lego is Lego, people. Saying you play with Legos is like saying you eat spaghettis.
Right.
It drives me crazy.
Legos, Legos, Legos.
I like coffees with my soups.
And spaghettis.
Exactly.
So if you'd like to join in torturing Carrington, drop us a line at feedback.
That's feedback with a T.
And an extra S. Okay. So Paul, you have resurrected something?
Yes. I have not. But Steve Chamberlain has. So for probably, I don't know, it's been like a year or something, we've been hearing about the lack of sourcing for these DB19 connectors, which are the connectors that the disk drives, like the Macintosh disk drives and old Apple things, and apparently also old Next things, used to connect to storage. And people stopped making them. You know, they used to be used all the time in the industry, and then they weren't anymore. And so the supply was drying up. And so Steve Chamberlain is the one who's behind Big Mess of Wires and makes the floppy emu, which is a kind of like a universal old Apple drive thing. You know, it's a disk drive for a Mac. We've talked about it before, for a Lisa, for an Apple II. It relies on this connector. And so he had been kind of like trying very hard to get pretty much all of them that are left in the world so that he could build his things, and it was clear that they were he was going to run out. And so for a while, we probably have even talked about this before, he's kind of looked at options for maybe building them or 3D printing pieces of them, or, you know, like trying to figure out some way to solve this problem when these connectors are no longer possible. And he initially had about a year ago or something looked into manufacturing them, and everybody thought he was insane. You know, that no one would even talk to him mostly about making new ones. And but he came back around to that idea when he sort of became aware that the Next community, and I think the Atari ST community, there's a number of other retro computing communities besides the Mac that needs these and is running out. And so he worked out a group buy of something like 10,000 of these things, and they have just arrived at his house. So he says that for the moment, at least, I have nearly the entire world's supply of DB19 connectors stacked in my living room. Actually, the next sentence is great. I think I'm going to fill the bathtub and swim in them. But
I think we can insert evil laugh here.
Yeah, but this is very good news, because I mean, the floppy emu is a very useful piece of technology, and it was very sad to think that it was going to become impossible to make, or you know, with flaky connectors or whatever. And this is great that he managed to. So he went in with some other people. He didn't buy this on his own, but and it didn't. He didn't say exactly how much it cost, but five digits, like kind of cost. Wired to somewhere in China. So he relates the story of how that kind of went down, and I guess we'll be hearing more about that in the future. But that's really something that it actually happened, that there are actually new ones made now.
No, I think it's great that someone's taken the plunge on getting this done. There are so many other connectors out there that people have struggled to fabricate their own in their own workshops, but it's great that he's finally got them on, literally on his doorstep, or possibly bathtub.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that wraps up the news and interesting items for this episode. So here's a word from someone who could be interesting.
Commander, another Cylon fighter approaching.
Answer to my console. Here comes another one.
Maybe that's them.
Switch to attack computer frequency. No flashing red dot. Activate laser guns.
No, sir, don't fire. It's them.
How do you know?
They're waggling! Waggling?
Just keep waggling, buddy.
Thinking about a new car?
And check out 1985's Car of the Year. This year, Kit has more amazing features and more incredible powers than ever. And September 30th, you can see them all.
I can't wait.
If you can't wait, call 1-900-210-KITT and find out more.
Michael?
Easy, buddy.
Okay, and we're back. So, I was wondering, what could I possibly put in for the host retro computing gift idea? And then I thought, how about a USB kit?
Michael?
So, if you just can imagine you're driving in your car, and you suddenly have an 80s nostalgia attack, what would be better than having your own piece of kit in your car? Plugs into the cigarette lighter, and provides charging points for two of your USB devices. And of course it has blinking lights, and it has voice feedback. You know, it's quite an interesting little kit. And the good thing is, it's only $14.99 plus delivery. It's on special. So if you rush now, you too can have your own bit of Knight Rider kit USB car charger.
Welcome aboard the Knight 2000.
Thank you. What's all this?
Like Darth Vader's bathroom.
So, any room for this in your cars, guys?
I can't actually get any more single. I don't know what this is supposed to accomplish.
Yeah.
That said,
it's cool.
I really like it.
Yeah. What, Carrington being desperately single?
I am already married a long time, fairly secure. I don't think this would jeopardize that. I actually thought it was pretty cool and very reasonable price.
Yeah, even on the normal price, I've got it on a sale, so say 50%. But I can see a spot in my little Toyota Yaris for this. It's not quite a Pontiac Trans Am, but it gets me there.
Cool. There's also, if you want to keep going on this, you can install a little like LED scanner for the front of your car. I put an instructables link in there to that.
Mm.
You're killing me.
That's always the, like, the first electronics project anyone does, right?
Do a chaser, yeah. Little. I always like to think it's more of a Cylon thing myself.
Oh, yeah. Hmm. Maybe they're related.
Hmm. Now, that's a scary thought. So, what other treasures do we have out there? So, while you're on a roll, Carrington, what have you got?
Picking something with vroom vroom noises in it. I am selecting a complete boxed copy of Full Throttle for the Macintosh. It's the Mac version, which was a version I played, and it's one of my favorite of the old LucasArts point-and-click adventure games. Really, really terrific one. Didn't appear in a lot of the LucasArts collections, I think, so it's a little bit more rare, but not a particularly rare game. But this is a nice complete boxed copy. $40.80 US is the price, with $25 shipping to me. It's coming from Copenhagen, Denmark, though, so maybe cheaper out on the continent. I just really like it. I've been itching to replay it, so it caught my eye. I won't be purchasing this version, but I dig it. And I also was selecting it so that I could also put in a link in to the Scum VM site to remind people that there's a nice, simple, easy way to legally play these games on a modern computer. So Scum VM is a free emulator, and it doesn't actually ship with these sorts of games, but if you want to play the old LucasArts games, and also like Simon the Sorcerer and Beneath a Steel Sky, and like all those graphical point-and-click adventure games, which are so awesome, you can run Scum VM, and how that works is you run Scum, you put an actual disc of one of these games, pop it in your computer, it reads from the disc the bits that it needs, but it can play the actual the game part itself, and it's just taking the basically the copyrighted bits from the game. So you can play, like, for instance, this version of Full Throttle for Macintosh. You can put this disc in your modern computer and play it no problem with the free Scum player. So these are very accessible games, and they are terrific, and they hold up, and they're wonderful. And $40 is a completely reasonable price for this very nicely boxed copy.
Hmm.
Cool. Yeah, and I had forgotten what Scum VM was until you said that, so that's good. Thank you for reminding at least me.
Yeah, and it works so well too. Like, it's there's a version, current stable version for Windows, for Mac, for Linux, for like tons of things, and it'll play the versions of the games from tons more than that. Like, you can play the Dreamcast version of one of these games on your computer, or like tons of things, like the PSP version or the BOS version. If you want to play like a particular version of the game, you can use Scum to do that. And it's just really terrific. So if you've got these games, and a lot of times you can pick up these discs, you can pick up like The Dig for $4. Just get the disc from eBay, and you're good to go. And you can now play it on your modern computer. So it unlocks a whole bunch of really amazing games that are readily and cheaply available.
Excellent.
So literally you just pull the binaries out of the title that you buy and run Scum VM and you're off.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It does technically work with disk images as well, but that doesn't become the legal version that I'm promoting here at the moment.
Of course.
So, but since these disks are available, like I recently there was a copy of The Dig on eBay for, I think, $3.95 or $4.50 or something like that. And that's a very typical price for a lot of these games. So it is as cheap to do it legally as it would to go buy a remade version for iOS or something. So it's much more fun to play it with an actual disc and to do it fully legally. And Scum itself, Scum VM, is free. So it's great. Really, really good option that plays these games perfectly.
Maybe I could finally finish Day of the Tentacle.
It will play that.
Mm. That was a fun game.
Mm.
Okay, Earl, while you've got the mic, you've got a very interesting piece of kit here.
Yeah.
Tell me about this digital server.
Actually, I want to talk about another kit real quick, the one that you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The Cylon kit similarity in the lights weren't by accident. I just went and looked this up again. According to IMDb, at least, Glenn Larson borrowed the idea of Kit's hood-mounted scanner from one of his earlier projects, Battlestar Galactica. So there you have it. The Cylons and Kit don't look similarly by accident. It's kind of plagiarizing from yourself, which I guess you technically can't do. But let's look at now another kit, which is this Digital Server 5000, otherwise known as an Alpha Server 1200, so they're confusing me with their branding. But this isn't as retro as some of the things that you might see. If I understand it, this was from the early 90s, but it is an Alpha chip-based server, and I think this initial price is extremely reasonable, $50, plus, to me, from Texas, $42 shipping. So if this didn't get any other bids, I could have it for less than $100. That's not going to wind up being the case. These old Alpha servers, whether they're desktops or actual server form factor boxes, are real popular for running OpenVMS, the hobbyist edition. So if you want to get a license for OpenVMS as a hobbyist, non-commercial, you can do that. And you can run that operating system along with all the fantastic, what they call the layered products, the different languages and such, and it's a lot of fun.
I'd be able to run the NT for Alpha on this, wouldn't I?
You also would be able to do that.
I think I've got a copy of that. Well, the real deal, boxed.
Yeah.
I don't know where I came across it, but yeah, it's just part of my OS collection.
One of my goals, I have the right connector, or I need the right connector to do it. I have what's called an Alpha Multia, which was an old, really small form factor based computer based around the Alpha chip, and they were used kind of like thin clients back in the day, but they would run Windows NT, the Alpha version. All I need is a connector so I can hook it up to an external CD player to install that. And I want to try that myself. I remember Windows NT really was blazingly fast on an Alpha. It was great. But if I had this digital server, the Alpha Server 1200, I would run OpenVMS on it. I imagine that's what someone will buy it to do. And even in the notes, they say runs OpenVMS hobbyist version. You could also run True64 Unix, Linux for Alpha, and they say Windows NT, but why? Not opinionated or anything. But this baby's operational, and I think it'll probably sell for a lot more.
It looks very substantial as a physical object.
I bet it's not light. And so I was surprised by the $42 shipping.
Yeah,
but that's shipping just to you, though. That's like ship it to Earl. What about shipping to other people?
Right. I don't know. Paul, what do you see for shipping?
No, that's what I'm seeing, too, 4260. Mm. So I suspect
if you ship it to Earl.
Yeah. No, it's – yeah, I think this person could lose out on shipping.
Oh, yeah.
If there is only one bid.
Yeah, definitely looks like more than $50 shipping, way more. It doesn't ship to Australia, though, so –
There's an old Mac, actually it's not even exactly a Mac, and forgetting what it's called, the network, Apple network server, I think, that kind of looked like this.
The AUX one?
Yeah, it has the same kind of like big, huge box, very heavy shape to it that I would not mind getting a hold of one, but I don't even know how I could possibly do that unless it happened to be like in the basement of my next door neighbor or something.
Oh, no, they're nice, yeah. AUX and the machine's very nice.
But I think, I mean, they're very small, very few in number.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say small, but small in number, but not small in size. Okay, now, I came across a few little interesting items. I was actually searching for another data set. I've got one, and it's having a few problems, not belt related, so I thought I'd look at getting a second unit. But what popped up in my search was not what I was after. So what I found is a mouse pad that is done with a printed data set on it. So it looks very incongruous beside modern hardware, but very tempted to get this. They obviously are in quantity, so I won't be snatching it away from any of our readers, but I thought I'd also have a look to see what else is available from this seller. So, three other mouse pads, which are probably going to be headed my way. So there's also the Commodore 64 logo, I should say model branding, and the one that I like is just, it's ready. So we'll include links to these mouse pads, but if you're after something a little bit Commodore-ish to sit on your desk with all your modern-day equipment, here's a couple of choices for you.
Oh, yeah, I'll jump right on this.
I was going to get an Atari one, especially for you.
It just says boo.
Yeah, oh, that would be very nice.
That would be pretty sweet. We got to make those bring up to K-Fest.
Yes. But no, I just love the look of the dataset one. It just it just looks great. I've already clicked to buy it now for that one, so hopefully it'll get here in good time. But what the heck, you know.
Nice.
€370 for shipping and €395 just for the mouse pad. It's worth it. Okay. Jack, Atari Falcon, you found one.
I found one. So we were talking about this, the very first story we had about Matt Lacey coding up stuff on a Falcon. I looked around. These things are actually pretty rare. And I remember when they were rare when they came out because Atari was already at that time in 1992, just terrible at selling anything. And so, like, they made some of these. I remember a guy in college, I remember Michael Curran talking about this. He was super excited about it, and I was like, wow, I had not even heard of this thing, and it just disappeared. But they are still, they can be found. This one I found has a buy-it-now price of 1,495 British pounds.
Ouch.
Wow, ouch. That's only $2,100 Australian, or $49.95 US.
Pretty crazy.
Canadian
so,
money doesn't go that high.
No, it's more than there is in Canada. So
more than our GDP. So we're not allowed to buy that.
So, but if you got an itching for doing some Falcon programming based on that article, here you go. You're all set. You just need to plunk down some change. This does include a bunch of software also, so it's actually not just the thing. It's a whole bunch of music software, like there's Cubase and Steinberg and other things. So if you're into that kind of thing, there it is. To me, that seems like just like crazy money for what it is, but that's me.
Hmm. Well, if all those titles are original, this person's probably bought the entire stock of software available for the Falcon.
Could be.
It's got those trapezoid buttons that I hate from this era of Atari.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate those things.
I like the logo. I hadn't seen Atari written in this kind of like refrigerator letter type
right.
style before. I don't know if they had ever did this, but it's like a blue, green, yellow, red, and pink letters yeah. in sequence.
Yeah, I don't think any of the other products ever had that sort of colorful logo. So,
way to be consistent.
Seems to be a neat machine, especially, I mean, compared to the Atari ST, which was kind of lackluster compared to things like the Amiga. This was a nice upgrade, but sold miserably. And, of course, the price you can buy it for now on eBay in this auction is, I think, a good bit more than it sold for new.
So it would have actually been a good investment.
Yeah, would have been.
If only you could tell that ahead of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like, oh, this is so bad, it's going to be worth squillions in 20 years' time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if any have sold. Yeah, no, there was one that sold for $2,000 beginning of last month. So that's a going price.
Yeah. Yeah, they are very pricey.
Hmm. Oh, I hope I trip over one. I'll kick it to the side. Okay. Paul, I know you're ready, but are we ready? What have you found?
Well, there's a couple of these I'm just going to mention. So I think at least the first one is going to be over, you know, practically before we hang up here. But it is an Apple One has gone on eBay. It's kind of a weird place to put an Apple One. I don't actually know how the mechanics of selling something that's going for like $56,000 is, you know, like with the 10% PayPal fee and all that stuff. But at any rate, it's kind of neat. It's anyway, it's kind of weird to see it, I guess.
If you're going to sell through an auction house, you're going to pay their commission anyway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And this probably will go for less. I mean, it's at $55,000 right now. There's only an hour, just about 2 hours left. It'll probably go up a little more, but yeah, it's just
I guess the
crazy.
Market has crashed for these things.
Well, it's eBay, though, so even if I had like $60,000 to put into one of these, I really am not sure that I'd want to do it on eBay.
But he's got 77 positive feedbacks.
Oh, that's true. That's sort of apropos for the next one.
I'm out. It doesn't ship to Australia. Okay, I'm just going to have to keep my money.
Yeah.
But yeah, if it was through a auction house, it hopefully would have someone to come in and certify that it's the real deal. I don't know. There's lots of stuff that I buy on eBay, but I don't think Apple One computers are on that list.
Well, I think there's. I don't think there's any reason to think this isn't real. It is, and it's actually kind of a little bit beat up as these go. But there was some discussion of it on I think the VCF mailing list or CC Tech. I don't know. I believe that it is real, but and it's interesting to see. So if you want to know what the current eBay price is of an Apple One, then you will know by the time the show notes are up. Okay, and then you know, sort of thematically related, just today, there was a Rev Zero Apple II that was put up for $30,000 buy it now. So just a little cheaper than the Apple One.
A little cheaper, a little bit more useful.
I got to ask, are we not past now the era in which every single Apple thing that gets sold has to have Steve Jobs in the title?
I guess not.
Yeah, that's looking forward to the not.
But this is a different Steve Jobs.
It's kind of interesting to see it. You don't see, this is actually a pretty complete set, and it is cased serial number 1144. So it is a Rev Zero.
Super high blown out photos, though, which hides a lot of imperfections in photos. So I would not trust these photos. They are way too hot.
You think?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Looking at them you would have no idea what the color of this case really is, or if there's blemishes and stuff, like, cuz it's so blown out. I don't like it when photos do that, cuz it's like, dude, how is your camera actually that bad, or like what's going on here? Because if I go into Photoshop, I can like crank up the levels here and get this as well. And then there could be pencil writing all over this, or scratches, or like, and it just all vanishes when you make the things this hot.
Anyway, yeah, it's old. It's actually, the auction is by the guy who sells the Newton One, Apple One replicas. So if you look in his other items, he's selling the replica boards and even a built one. And also an IBM 360 mainframe faceplate, control faceplate, which is very cool. Neat. So
that would be super fun to have. Mm. Holy cow.
Yeah. It's not working because there's nothing behind it.
Yeah, but
it.
Rather than that kit thing, I'd put this in my car.
Yes.
Ladies.
Prepare to be amazed.
Emergency pull, I guess it says. The big red button in the upper right. I was taking a look at this panel, and I've seen pictures of the IBM 360 panels before, but you can actually sort of look at what all the little knobs say. You know, like the monitor voltage select and margin voltage select, and there's a little storage test. You can choose zeros, ones, processed, worst, or reverse worst. I don't know what these are.
Amazing.
Reverse worst, please.
Do you mean best?
No, reverse the worst.
I don't understand.
It would be really quite interesting, actually, to know like what all of these things do. Apart from just aesthetically, like seeing all the lights light up, I'd kind of like to know how to use one sometime.
Oh, this would be my... If it wasn't so expensive, this would be my door project for Kansas Best. It'd be great. Wire the thing up and go, have a secret code to enter the door. Stand outside in my towel after showering for 5 hours. I don't know how to do this.
You have to toggle in a loader.
Well,
first.
I think we just found out what reverse worst is.
Yeah. Let's see. What else? What else did I want to say here? So those are the interesting ones, the main interesting ones.
No way, your foot thing.
No, foot mouth is interesting. I want foot mouth.
So, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, I guess I can't skip that one. It isn't actually exactly vintage, although it's, you know, or retro or whatever. But it is 1996 for Macs of that era. But it's a mouse input device that you run with your feet. So it's called the No Hands Mouse.
Was this for people that weren't like? They didn't have use in their hands, or was this just for convenience so you could keep your hands on the keyboard while you were mousing?
It doesn't seem like it's specifically for, you know, like helping with impairments or anything like that. I suppose it could. I think it is supposed to just give you extra, you know, interaction limbs.
I kind of love this though, because like I fell in love with the Mac and mouse operating computing, which is what Mac stands for. As soon as I first saw them many, many, many decades ago. But one of my first thoughts though was, where's the third hand? If I need two for the keyboard and one for the mouse, this has got to be a problem. And it's a problem that's never been solved until finally they said, oh, let's just get rid of it and go to tablets. So this might be really cool. I'm sitting in front of a computer right now that uses a mouse. So This might be the solution I have been waiting for.
It's got, one of them is Mark Cursor and the other one's click. So I just want to know, how do you left kick or right kick something?
I think you roll your foot around to move it like a trackball kind of thing. I don't know. This is fascinating.
Yeah, it would
this
be
is the best thing you chose. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and it works probably fairly well on the Mac because at least early on there was no right, you know, left and right click. There was only click. So.
Now you need another foot to right click.
or some sort. Actually, there, another thing I didn't pick somewhere along the line was there was some kind of corded input. I'm not sure exactly.
Oh, I had one of those. It was a nightmare.
it looks like it would be kind of fun to learn how to use, but also apparently a big
no.
Like,
the problem with the corded
problem.
Keyboard is when you're writing something, you feel like you're the Phantom of the Opera. I am composing my masterpiece. I mean, it's the most ridiculous way to type.
Okay, but yes.
Sorry, well, lovers of QWERTY keyboards, but I mock you all. But the foot mouse, on the other hand, I totally think sounds reasonable.
Yeah. This is I kind of want to get one. I think there is just the one. It is a $70 buy it now. But let's see. I put in a link to an Acorn Electron in its box. And I don't think I'm going to say much about this except that it's one of the more complete things I have seen. I mean, it's not just an Acorn Electron, you know, dirty from sitting in the basement, no cords available. It has, you know, it has the box, it has the tape data recorder, it has some sort of cartridge expander on it, and some software and stuff. So if you were looking for one of these, this is the one to get, I think. It's the bids start at £55, and I think it will ship to the United States, but doesn't say for how much, so...
Holy cow, foot mice are still a thing. There's tons that are USB foot mice. That's like a whole category of stuff I didn't know still existed, so I'm just preempting all awesome. The email we were going to receive about it. But it turns out they're super popular in certain industries. Like if you're transcribing, there's foot mice to not do mice, but to control like the speed of audio playback and stuff. I never knew any of this. And there's current like the USB foot mouse, programmable pedals, so like multi-buttons. they've gotten crazy complicated. Who knew?
I'm just hearing, you know, John Lithgow in Buckaroo Banzai when he was in that ship. And he's like, come on, feet, do your stuff.
Big bootay. John Smallberries, John Yaya. That is one of the best movies ever.
I agree.
Very good. Yes, I will have to look into modern foot mice.
It would be like playing Dance Dance Revolution all day long. I'm the lord of the dance. Watch me type.
Okay, so I think we can leave it. Well, all right, I'll mention one more thing. It's not an eBay thing. But Jason Scott had tweeted having discovered this in Japan, and I went and kind of looked, and it seems like a couple of years ago, ThinkGeek, I think it was, sold this, but it is a music modem keyboard instrument toy. It is called the Music Modem. It is shaped like a little, you know, U.S. robotics sportster from the mid-old days. And it has little buttons you can press that will make modem sounds. So it's a little thing you can get for $33 on Amazon. And it will entertain you for three
seconds.
Minutes.
Minutes.
Seconds of entertainment. Okay. Well, that was the wonderful world of eBay. And Amazon. So, guys, any closing discussions? Carrington, what are you up to?
Last night I went to the Canadian finals to select our B-boy dance champion. And I learned that there's a new definition for the word cipher. Turns out a cipher is a competition where people get together and do their breakdancing. If you do a breakdance battle, a b-boy battle, or b-girl battle, that is called a cipher. This was all news to me. And so I went to the Canadian National Finals last night, and there was popping and locking as well, and a beatbox demonstration. But we have selected our Canadian national champion, and he'll be heading off to Japan shortly to compete in the world B-boy dance-off finals. And what was fun is, not only was I far more than twice as old as everybody else in a 30-kilometer radius, which was amazing, but also it's like this whole community that I was just like an anthropologist among them, right? And I stood there and I'm like, if I don't interact, this counts as science. And I will simply watch them in their native. It was amazing. Talking to the community and using all these terms I did not understand. They keep calling it a cipher. I'm like, that's not what that word means, but okay. And it was just really interesting. So it was the final 16 from all across Canada got together and they battled. And I had no idea why some would win over others, but the judges would pick. Oh, and they don't just select the winner. The three judges would hold up the graffiti tag of the person who competed. And so they'd always hold up the winner. I'm like, I have no idea which one that is. I couldn't read any of it. It was amazing. And so that's what I did last night. And I highly recommend it if you have an opportunity to do this sort of thing. It was great.
I don't know if there was ever any doubt, but you were, this guarantees you were the most eclectic among our.
I'm living the life, man. I am living the life. It was fantastic. So that's what I did with my Saturday night.
I think Carrington is eclectic amongst the eclectic.
It was great.
I think so.
It was fantastic. I loved it. All the kids had such a good time and I watched them.
Cool.
Well, that certainly tops anything I've been doing. Oh, anything happening over at your side of the planet?
Well, something a little bit eclectic. As I mentioned before the show started, last weekend I was up in Vancouver, British Columbia, up in Carrington Land. And we, among other things, went to what's called the Richmond Night Market. I'm told it's the largest night market in North America, and it was astoundingly large. There are more than 100 food booths alone going there, and an overwhelmingly Asian demographic here, and so lots of really yummy Asian food.
Ooh, sampling 100 booths, I'm up to the challenge.
The problem wasn't having food available. The problem was that there was just so many good choices and you had to narrow it down to one or two. And so it was really fun and it just unbelievably crowded there and pretty warm. Actually, it was a warm night and they had my K-pop music going there at the stage and they had lots of fun booths where you could also just shop for either trinkets or different sort of weird electronic things. And so anyway, if you happen to be in Vancouver during the summer months and you can get to this Richmond Night Market, I would say go do that because that was a ginormous amount of fun. And that's what's going on my end. Not very retro, but a heck of a lot of fun.
Okay, save us, Jack. Have you been doing anything retro that's interesting? Actually, retro is interesting. What am I saying?
What are you saying? Actually, no, I haven't. It's terrible.
You haven't.
Because what happens? In Sweden, we have this thing where the other bad thing about besides bad garage sales is just bad weather. Like, it's so dark and so cold for so long that as soon as the sun starts to come out, like I always say that as soon as there is a single warm day in May, everyone is like, oh my God, I gotta go out and use the sunlight, because that might be the last warm, sunny day of the year. So I've been actually trying to just, I've been spending all of my free time out in the yard fixing stuff and painting things and mowing things and stuff. So
fixing up all the stuff outside so it can get covered up with snow and then you do it again next year.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. This sounds like the arguments about, like, why make the bed?
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, well.
Okay. Paul, in your Aladdin's cave of newly acquired bits and pieces, what have you been up to?
Well, yeah, actually, I too have been primarily just trying to, like, catch up on work so I can have time in the future to do retro stuff. I am sort of, you know, in my mind mentally preparing for Kansas Fest. I have submitted a talk proposal. I do not know if it is going to be accepted yet, but we shall see. But yes, that's very soon. That's very exciting. I can't both hope it hurries up and gets here, and then hope it kind of waits a little bit so that I have enough time to prepare.
Yeah. Well, I'll continue the Kansas Fest theme. I've got all my travel arrangements locked in, so I'm going to start my little trip to Kansas Fest by going to Seattle. And I'm going to, 7th of July, anyone in the Seattle area, I'm heading off to the Living Computer Museum. So if you're in town...
That's actually not very far. I don't think that's too far from where Kevin Savitz lives.
Ah.
Hey, you got the name in there.
Almost didn't make it.
Ooh-ah!
Level up time. No, so if anyone's in the Seattle area and you want to catch up and say hi, I'll be at the Living Computer Museum, which is open late on the first Thursday of the month, so I've actually timed my arrival in Seattle so that I can actually spend as much time as I can manage at the museum. So really looking forward to that. And then I'm just going to take a little slow tour through Canada and then end up in Missouri. So really looking forward to Kansas Fest. I think everyone should try to get to their own retro computer conference exhibits or whatever. So whatever computer you're into, I think you should really try and find something like this that's going on, or even help out in getting one going. I know that I have a lot of fun here in Australia with the local guys. Getting things done, but it's something that you've really got to do. So there's so many sport for choice in the US, of course, but it's just something that I really look forward to getting in and catching up with people, looking at old computers, playing with software. Okay, so that's pretty much it for the show. So you'll find all our show notes at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at the Vintage Computer Federation. And of course, you can follow the RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join the Facebook group. We'll include a link to the Retro Computing Roundtable RCR Podcast group. And of course, there's good old-fashioned feedback. You can send us your retro experiences or questions or tips to feedback at rcrpodcast.com. We're also members of the Throwback Network, where you can find other similarly retro-themed podcasts for your enjoyment. And of course, if you're in iTunes, write us a review, help get the show higher up in the list so that it gets on the recommendeds for people and helps make it easier for them to find us. So guys, until next time...
Retro Compute!
With a T.